You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for joining us today here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. A big shout-out to the folks in Crozet's 1011 and the Valley as well. And let me thank the folks at The Backyard for support today, the university's culinary secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue across from Para Coffee. The Backyard invites you to enjoy outdoor patio seating in their heated tent provided by Commonwealth Event Company. The Backyard has a seasonal menu and seasonal brews on tap and is available for private events. For more info, it's 434-202-8215, or you can find The Backyard on Facebook. So thanks for tuning in. I think we have a pretty interesting and enlightening topic today. Where else can you find that except here on the Wake Up Call? We will be talking about menhaden, which is a special fish in the Chesapeake Bay. Our guests today, Chris Moore, a scientist from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and Sandy Houseman, who is with WVTF, the NPR station. Charlottesville News Bureau Chief. Ladies first, Sandy, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
And Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Chris Moore, unrelated, but obviously a blessed name, scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Write down the phone number if you have questions or comments, 979-0919. That's 979-0919. We can also be heard online a little further out. You need the toll-free number, 877-967-6762. All right. The fish itself. Let's just start at the beginning. Chris, actually, Sandy, you did a report on menhaden for WVTF and Radio IQ that I think I heard back in November.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the menhaden. Chris is here. We're going to talk about the ecological part of it and some of the other issues that go along with that. But tell me about the history, which seems to be the reporter's aspect.
The menhaden has been a target for fishermen for hundreds of years. Over in the Tidewater area, they've been fishing for menhaden since at least the early 1700s, if not the late 1600s. And way back then, it was known that this little fish was great for fertilizer. So that's the principal use back then. And then subsequently, the oil became valuable, and so the fishing industry boomed. Again, based on the menhaden, there were, I believe, 20 ports on the eastern coast where menhaden were fished. And Reedville, Virginia, was one of the richest areas. And if you go up there, it's a really charming little town with lots of old Victorian houses that were owned by sea captains who made their fortune fishing menhaden. More recently, a company called Omega Protein, which is based in Texas, began using the menhaden to produce fish oil supplements, omega-3 supplements, which you probably know are quite healthy for people and other animals, and also fish meal, which is used in pet food. And if you're there on a day when they happen to be cooking the menhaden, it smells like you put your nose in the dog food bag and took a deep sniff. It's a strong odor. Not everyone loves it.
One of the things that I found doing my research for this was, and I guess no one who could write this down who was there, but the Pilgrims taught those English folks coming over to put the menhaden around their corn.
Right. And by the way, you don't want to eat a menhaden because I haven't tried it, but I'm told it tastes pretty bad.
Well, I can say that I grew up. For two summers of my life, my best friend and I had 100 crab pots. We had a gill net, and the food that we caught to stuff in the crab pots were what we called bunker, but those are menhaden. And I think at some point early in the first summer, we decided to give the menhaden a try. And you're right. You shouldn't eat the menhaden because it's not just oily. It's full of bone. Mm. So the history of menhaden, that makes it sound interesting. not necessarily vital. It talks you talk about how it helps in growing plants, good fertilizer, important in terms of people earning their livelihoods from it. But Chris Moore from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, what makes it so vital and necessary?
From our perspective, the real vital nature of the menhaden population is its source as a forage fish, basically a food fish for a vast array of economically important species in the Chesapeake Bay. Striped bass, summer flounder, bluefish, species like that that are a real stalwart of our economy here in Virginia, both from a recreational perspective and from a commercial perspective, feed upon menhaden and rely upon menhaden for a vast part of their nutrition. In addition to fish, birds such as osprey have a real large component of their diet being menhaden, and we have obviously a very big bird watching industry here in Virginia as well. So it's another large component of the importance of menhaden to the state of Virginia and to the whole region.
And have we actually seen sport fishermen complaining that there's some drop in their catch, maybe because menhaden are not as common as they used to be?
I think there's been a number of complaints from the recreational fishing industry about the menhaden catch and how it may affect their catches. Not only one is there the fact that, yes, the less menhaden they are, the less healthy the striped bass are, but also there's kind of some turf wars at times between folks who are out fishing for striped bass, recreationally especially, and as the menhaden boats are out there trying to catch their menhaden, there's what we call user conflict. Both the industries are taking place in the same area, and it's tough for both of those to take place in the same area in the same time. And in fact, one of the outcomes of that has been actually that to try to reduce those conflicts, we don't see the menhaden fishery, the industrial fishery, the reduction fishery operate on weekends to try to reduce some of those conflicts moving forward, because it has been, I think, bad for everyone involved when we have those conflicts.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found to be so interesting when talking about this is, Sandy, you did your report for WVTF, and the thing that caught my interest the most was the balance in the report. And I assume that's always the goal of the reporter. But there's the issue that Chris brings up about the need for having the menhaden. And we'll continue into this topic throughout the hour as we talk about menhaden and the Chesapeake Bay, and the vital role that the menhaden play. But one of the things that you accomplished in your report was the importance of the job issue here in Virginia. And what makes people believe that there's a problem? There's a huge percentage of people who don't believe in global warming. What is going to make them believe to get the population on the side of caring and being concerned about menhaden when they don't believe in global warming? How do you prove to them that the menhaden need your attention?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge, I'm sure, for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and other advocates of the menhaden. I had never heard of them before I came to Virginia, and I was frankly surprised. You know, I came from Chicago, which is a place noted for political corruption. I was quite shocked to discover that here in Virginia, all of the catches of sport fish are regulated by the state, by a division of the state that actually is science-based, the Virginia Marine Fisheries Commission.
Marine Resources Commission.
Thank you. And the menhaden is an exception. The menhaden catch is regulated by the legislature. And surprisingly enough, the legislators do receive campaign contributions from Omega Protein, the company that profits from mass fishing of menhaden. Over the last 10 years, they've received $180,000 in campaign contributions. And last year, the governor got a $25,000 contribution from Omega Protein. So, you know, as a reporter and as a member of the public, I had to wonder what's going on here.
11:09 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk about menhaden. Our guest today, Sandy Houseman. She's the Charlottesville News Bureau Chief with NPR, WVTF, and Radio IQ. Chris Moore, a scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, here with us. Dial up if you have a question as we get a little further into the hour, 979-0919. Toll-free number, 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Let me take a moment to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports. You can find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports here in Charlottesville. They are featuring the Columbia Omni Heat, a waterproof down jacket with 700 fill power to provide protection from wet and cold weather. Columbia Omni Heat jackets are available at Blue Ridge Mountain Sports. That is the outdoor store that knows the outdoors. Chris, let's talk a minute about science, numbers. We're talking about how to make people understand the importance of menhaden. You mentioned the number of other fish and bay creatures that use menhaden as food, but menhaden have their own job in the bay, sort of clearing it up, clearing it out.
Well, they do feed on algae, which we have an overabundance of in the bay, but really their primary ecological function in the bay is to serve as food for these other species. They're really kind of the protein source for striped bass and other fish like that. They're also very important for our commercial fisheries as bait for fisheries like the crab fishery, and a lot of them actually caught in the bay are shipped up to the northeast for lobster fisheries and things like that. But the Bay Foundation has really been focused on the fact that to have a healthy bay, we need to have a healthy ecological system that has lots of predators that folks like to catch either commercially or recreationally, but also has enough food for those. And what we've begun to see is that as we've done a really good job restoring some of these species, like striped bass, like summer flounder, the food needs that are out there with that growing population is not being sustained by the menhaden population that's currently out there now. And we really need to look closely at that predator-prey relationship and make sure that as we're doing a really good job making tough decisions and restoring some of these vitally important recreationally and economic important species, that we have the food sources out there for them so that the recovery efforts that we undertake are sustained into the future.
When you say the food needs are not being sustained, how do you know that? I mean, you can't question a striped bass as to whether he's getting enough menhaden this week.
Right. Some of the studies that we use to know that, they actually look at the diet of striped bass. We've looked at diets of ospreys as well. And if you look at the diet of striped bass 30, 40, 50 years ago, in some cases it was as much as 80% menhaden. If you look at the diets of ospreys 20, 25, 30 years ago, it was as much as 75% menhaden. Now we're looking at diets of striped bass maybe as low as 10%. Menhaden. We're looking at diets of ospreys maybe as low as 5 to 10% menhaden. So we can see that they're not having that same component or that amount of menhaden in their diet. In addition, the length-to-weight ratio of striped bass especially is beginning to shrink. The fish aren't as fat and healthy as they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And those are some of the indicators that something is wrong in the ecosystem and they're not getting the nutrition they need. Is it definitely pointing to just menhaden? No, there's a lot going on in the bay that we need to fix. But it's one of kind of a growing group of indicators that we use to look at this predator-prey relationship.
I guess I'm wondering about the technique. Do scientists actually observe these fish in the wild as to what they're eating?
No, they actually usually, what we do, they're called gut content analysis. So commercial fishermen who are harvesting fish, or in some cases researchers, will actually go out, catch the fish. They'll put their stomachs into a jar and take them back, freeze them, and over the next couple months, they'll actually go through and identify all the prey items that are in there. In some cases with ospreys, we have enough cameras out there where they'll actually look at the nest and see what the birds have been eating, but right. Most of it is done through that gut content analysis.
And I'm wondering why it matters. I mean, you say that the amount of menhaden has declined to 10% in some fish, but isn't that like a person who eats less chicken and more pork, or during the summertime has less fall vegetable and more summer fresh vegetable? I mean, I'm not going to die because I trim my diet from something that I normally eat and make it just a small percentage of my food. I'm still going to continue to eat.
Right. You're exactly right. You're probably not going to die from that. The issue that we're seeing with striped bass and other species in Chesapeake Bay because of this lack of protein in their diet is the fact that they're becoming more susceptible to other diseases or to other environmental strains because of this. Mycobacteriosis is the disease that's infecting a lot of striped bass, especially in Chesapeake Bay. We're still learning a lot about how that actually functions within the population of striped bass and things like that, but we know that a healthy fish, a healthy human anyway, is better able to fight off disease, to fight off stresses, and when fish aren't as healthy as they should be, they will succumb to those other stressors. And in fact, we know natural mortality, not fish that we catch in the bay, is increasing in the population of striped bass, and that's not a good thing.
So they need their own omega-3.
That's right.
I've actually heard critics suggest, though, that because there are large dead zones in Chesapeake Bay and because we know that mycobacteriosis often occurs because fish are crowded, that maybe that's what we're seeing, that this really doesn't have to do with diet so much as the fact that there's less space for the striped bass?
There's definitely a possibility of that happening, and it could be one of the situations where the fish are being crowded by the dead zones in the summer, and then you just having that may be okay, but when you reduce the amount of prey available to them in the area, they're even more crowded. It's kind of that synergistic effect where two or three different things are happening and causing this lack of health in the overall population.
11:16 here on the Makeup Call as we talk about menhaden and the Chesapeake Bay. Guest today, Sandy Houseman. She's the Charlottesville News Bureau Chief from our WVTF and Radio IQ. Chris Moore, scientist from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, actually drove up from the Norfolk, Virginia Beach area to be with us today. And 11:16. Chris, there's Virginia legislature out there for this year to protect the menhaden. There was legislature in 2010. Sandy, you mentioned the fact that the menhaden, asking Chris a question about the menhaden being protected by the Virginia legislature rather than ecological organizations like Virginia Marine Resources Commission, Chesapeake Bay Foundation. So, Chris, start off by telling me how that happens. It's the only fish in the area protected by that, correct?
It is. The Virginia Marine Resources Commission manages all of our marine and tidal species in Virginia, and that's not only finfish like striped bass and summer flounder, but they also manage oysters, clams. They manage the habitat, basically all the land that's underwater in Virginia. And they really started out just managing oysters. Over a long period of time, though, the General Assembly used to manage all of our marine species, but basically started moving all of the management responsibilities to VMRC through various acts and things like that.
Why would you do that?
I think it was really just a time commitment and a knowledge commitment for the General Assembly. Our General Assembly only meets for 45 days one year, 60 days the next year, and trying to deal with these very complex fisheries management issues during that very shortened period of time is very tough. Currently as well, a lot of our species that migrate up and down the coast are managed cooperatively with other organizations such as the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and when they set forth kind of a conservation goal or a regulation that needs to be adopted by the state, it may be in June, it may be in July, it may be in September, and the states need to comply with that usually fairly quickly, within a couple months' time. Obviously, our General Assembly only meets in January, February, maybe the first part of March, and it's very tough to, it would be very tough for the state of Virginia to comply with those type of conservation mandates. We wouldn't want to call the General Assembly back to deal with an issue on striped bass or something like that. So it's really in the state's best interest in a lot of cases to have all the management decisions at the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. They meet monthly. They have very good professional staff that work on fisheries issues day in and day out. They obviously, just like the General Assembly but they have the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, which has some of the best fishery scientists on the East Coast to give them advice about how they manage this. And they really are in tune with what's going going on. In addition to just the commission, they also have set up a group of advisory committees that are representative of different areas in the state and different conservation interests, different commercial interests in the state to help advise them on that process. And it's worked very well. We've seen them do a great job. We've seen blue crab numbers triple over the last 3 years due to some tough decisions they've made. VMRC was managing striped bass. We know that fish was basically commercially and recreationally extinct in Virginia. Now we have, population-wise, some of the highest numbers of striped bass ever, still worried about their health now. But it really has been a good situation for Virginia in terms of managing its marine resources.
All right, so they've done a great job giving that information or allowing the Virginia Marine Resource Commission and other scientist groups to take care of it, except they have yet to give them the Menhaden. So we'll come back in just a second and follow up on that. 979-0919-1877-WNRN Rocks. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs 40 to 45, upper 30s in the valley. Mostly cloudy with flurries after midnight tonight, lows 20 to 25. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 30% chance of snow, sleet, and rain, highs in the mid-30s. Right now, there's cloudy outside, fair in the valley where it's 39, clouds in Lynchburg at 44, in Richmond 42, 44 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
All right, support today also coming from Dixon Disposal. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come, as well as our bay. When Dixon picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. More info, 978-2111, DixonDisposal.com. And WNRN reminds you that Piedmont Virginia Community College's spring semester classes begin on Tuesday. You can prepare for a new career or update your job skills or save big by starting your bachelor's degree at PVCC. You can get more info and register online at pvcc.edu. On the phone at 977-3900. Or the semester begins Tuesday the 18th, you can shine at PVCC. All right, 1122 here on the Wake Up Call, speaking about Menhaden and the Chesapeake Bay, learning a lot from Chris Moore, who's a scientist at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Sandy Houseman, Charlottesville News Bureau Chief at WVTF, who did a very, I found it to be engaging and just made me want to do this show. You can find the podcast online. Go to WVTF. It's a two-part piece. I believe it's a little over 3 minutes for each one. And again, one of the things that I found most informative was hearing both sides. We're talking this so far about how important the Menhaden is ecologically, and we're going to get shortly into why it's so important for at least part of the state and the country. Financially, we got a call coming in. Let's see. Let's take this up. Nope. Everyone just made their comments. Here, let's do this one first. Chris, we were talking about how so much of the Bay population is overseen by scientific groups. Except for the Menhaden, this one group. Why? Why this one group? Sandy mentioned the possibility of the Omega Protein Corporation giving money to science, to politicians. Is that what it is? They bought their way and kept them as under the legislature?
Well, I don't know if that's definitely what happened. I think if you look at historically, what has happened is Virginia has pushed those responsibilities over to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission in somewhat of a haphazard manner at times. And a great example of that is the blue crab regulations. The vast majority of that is basically at VMRC now. They set the operative regulations. What's interesting, though, is the male size limit in Virginia for male crabs is still in Virginia state code. So only the General Assembly can change that. So there are pieces to this that it wasn't given over just in whole. It was kind of pushed over in pieces. And I think Menhaden is one that there's always been a lot of interest in that. I think there's probably been more kind of consternation between the various groups on Menhaden, and I just don't think the General Assembly has been comfortable at this point in ceding their authority to manage Menhaden to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission.
Well, and aside from Omega possibly holding some influence with lawmakers, the labor unions have gotten involved in this situation, especially in these hard economic times. The prospect of losing some or all of the 350 or so jobs in Tidewater, in the Northern Neck, I should say, concerns some labor unions. So now you have organized labor in the lobbying mix, and that could also be a factor.
We have a couple comments here. Don't forget 979-0919, the toll-free number 1-877-967-6762. The toll-free number again, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Guest today, Chris Moore, a scientist from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Sandy Hausman, who did a report on this topic, Menhaden and the Chesapeake Bay, for WVTF and Radio IQ. Call from Doug that says, Menhaden don't have a chance. Is he right? You want to hope and press and politicize even in some ways to make it so valuable and so important that the politicians must do the right thing. And there are bills from last year and bills from this year that we'll talk about.
Well, I think there's a couple different ways to look at that question. I think the first is from a fisheries perspective, the Menhaden fishery, especially the reduction fishery, is a very efficient fishery. They use very large boats. I think most people classify them as ships to actually catch the fish. They use spotter planes to identify the schools to then go in and catch. So it is a very efficient fishery. From a fisheries management perspective, though, I think things are really beginning to move in the right direction. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission that I mentioned earlier, they're the ones who really have a lot of the authority coastwide to manage Menhaden, and we're seeing them move in a much more conservationally minded approach the last couple years. About 5 years ago, we had the first ever cap on Menhaden within Chesapeake Bay. That was a conservation approach to make sure, as we did additional scientific studies, that we didn't over-harvest the fish in the interim while we try to do that. We've got some of that initial work done now that was going to take place during those 5 years. We know, based on the population model that we use to manage Menhaden, that the population is near all-time lows for our data set, and we have an incredible data set for Menhaden. It goes back to the mid-1950s. So the ASMSC process does move along fairly slowly, but I think we're going to see more and more conservationally minded decisions come out of our Menhaden management bodies here over the next couple of years.
Doing my homework online, there's a graph of, I guess, a scientific determined number of Menhaden in the bay. And it goes from, I guess, 1950, maybe slightly before 1950, through the recent years. I don't know if it goes all the way to 2010. But it has a cycle. It's up in the 1950s, it's down, and then it's back up to maybe its highest point in the early 1980s, and now it's down. And the comment that is made under this graph is that, oh, it's at its all-time low. Well, why can't it be a cycle? I mean, not that, again, it's... You have to look at both sides.
Right. And that graph is actually a coastwide graph. That's one of the real data gaps for us in managing Menhaden in the Chesapeake Bay is that we don't have a good feel for the number of fish in Chesapeake Bay. And that's been a real concern. We have great data coastwide, which is the graph that you were looking at. But unfortunately, we don't have it for localized or regional areas like Chesapeake Bay. But you're right. That number was up some of its highest points in the 50s. It dropped. You did see it increase during the 80s, and as we talked about earlier, what happened during the 80s? Our rockfish populations really plummeted. They just weren't found like they are now. And what you're probably seeing there, some of that is the fact that as the rockfish population bottomed out, the menhaden populations rose a bit because that predator-prey relationship is so important. Now that the rockfish population is back, the menhaden population has dropped down some. That's true. One of the warning signs for us, though, at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, hasn't been just that population going up and down. It's the fact that the number of small fish, the babies, getting back into the population in the fisheries management world, we call it recruitment, has been very low for about the last 20 years. And that was very much the same thing that happened in the blue crab population in Chesapeake Bay. The number was still kind of bouncing back and forth, although the bounces weren't as high or as low, but that bounce was getting narrower and narrower and narrower through the years. And when we don't have those recruits coming back into the population, it will lead us to really worry or concern about the future populations, because they're not going to have that ability to bounce back and forth. So that's one of the areas that has really been concerning for us. And as we move forward with managing this species, it's one of the things that ASMSC is currently looking at now. The population model that you're referring to and that they've used in the past is now showing that the ability of the menhaden to reproduce is somewhere between about 5% and 8% of an unfished stock. Virgin unfished stock, as we refer to it as. That's a pretty low number when you consider how big a population that is. And what ASMSC is now tasked the technical board at ASMSC to look at is some new, basically what we call reference points for the amount of reproduction in the stock, looking at possibly 10%, 15%, 25%, or 40%, and increasing the ability of the stock to reproduce, increasing that recruitment in the future, and then hopefully seeing some more of those highs in the population.
And two other thoughts about what could affect the future of the menhaden. First of all, every state along the Atlantic coast has banned reduction fishing of menhaden except Virginia, so that's possibly a positive sign. But the other question is what happens in the Gulf, where menhaden are also fished by omega protein, and omega protein is concerned by the spill and what impact that will have on menhaden in the Gulf. And they're kind of watching that. If young fish there are spoiled, in other words, if they're tissues become contaminated by the oil spill, then presumably they're not going to be used for fish oil supplements, and that puts more pressure on the Virginia populations.
Well, Sandy, while I try to bring up the opposing argument than Chris Moore from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation might have about fishing menhaden and their importance and potential decreasing numbers, Sandy Houseman from the Charlottesville News Bureau Chief WVTF, your article, you talked with people from Omega Protein in Reidsville. In fact, my favorite part of it is when you interview a guy who is talking about someone who moved down from Washington and calls him Captain.
Yeah.
That took me right back to my days in Pocosin where everybody was Captain.
Right.
What was the conversation that you had with people who lived in Reidsville in the Northern Neck, talking about why this isn't a concern? I can see what omega protein people might say, but what do the Virginians say about it?
You know, I think there's a good deal of trust in the company, especially if you work for the company, and a belief, and there's some credibility when a company says to you, it's not in our interest to overfish, we need to have this resource sustainable so that we can stay in business now and in the future. And I did speak with the chief biologist for Omega Protein, who, you know, points out that trying to figure out how many fish are out there in the ocean is a complicated business, and he's not convinced that there's a problem. And so I suppose people who work for Omega Protein simply trust that there's no overfishing, that, you know, there are millions and millions of these itty-bitty fish out there, and it's not something that we have to worry about. That said, you know, there are under 400 people that are working for this company. I mean, it's a relatively small group of folks who make their living fishing for menhaden. So, you know, if you look at the big picture and how critical these fish are to the health of the Chesapeake Bay and beyond, you have to wonder if this is an industry worth protecting.
Were you welcomed in Reidsville and by Omega Protein when you did this report?
You know, I contacted Omega maybe a year ago. I had been calling them off and on for months trying to get in to talk to people at the plant there. You know, I wanted to have a look around the plant. I wanted to go out on one of their ships. And their public relations guy, who is in, I think, Mobile, Alabama, said, yeah, we can do that. That's fine. We'll get back to you. And of course, I never heard back. So I ended up tracking down two company people at a conference, an Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Conference in Northern Virginia. Their attorney spoke with me and their chief biologist, and both of them were quite willing to talk. So, you know, I'd say that I wasn't, like, chased out of town with a shotgun. But the company wasn't, I don't think, overly anxious to have coverage on this issue. And the other thing that I've heard since is that they've gone out and hired a couple of consultants, perhaps in anticipation of new limits on how many fish they can take from the sea. A guy from North Carolina and another expert from South Africa to vouch for the fact that the population's not overfished.
Let me read this real quick about menhaden for those who are curious as to can you overfish it and why would you overfish it. The oil from their bodies is pressed out for use in cosmetics, linoleum, health food supplements, lubricants, margarine, soap, insecticide, and paints. Their dried out carcasses are then pulverized, scooped into huge piles, containerized, and shipped out as feed for domestic cats and dogs, farmed fish, and most of all, poultry and pigs. 11:36 here on the Wake Up Call. As we talk about menhaden in the Chesapeake Bay with Chris Moore and Sandy Houseman, let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be here today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. And at brgtshirts.com. Chris, quick question for you. Came from Katie here in Charlottesville. Slightly off topic, but thoughts on the coal plant being built near the bay?
An issue that's obviously been a concern for us. The biggest issue with Chesapeake Bay is basically what we call eutrophication. It's too many nutrients going into the bay and causing things like algae blooms and the dead zones that we mentioned earlier today. And there's a coal plant proposed for Surry County that CBF is very concerned about. It'll add an additional, very large additional load of nitrogen into the bay. And as I think most people who have been following the bay issues for the last year or so know, EPA has stepped forth and really doing a comprehensive effort to help the states clean up the bay, and this will be a significant new source of nitrogen, especially into the lower bay, at a time when cities, the states are all working very hard to reduce the nitrogen load. And a load like this is very tough for them to deal with. It would be a load primarily in the air, so it'll be falling upon their entire municipality, and they'll have to deal with it through their stormwater systems and things like that. So it's very much a concern for us, and it's a situation where we hope that something better than this old technology will move forward and we'll have a better way to supply our energy needs in the future.
All right, 11:38 here on the Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, last year's behemoth snowstorms caught many of us off guard, but does that mean we're all prepared this year? With plenty of winter left, The Hook provides tips to not only survive the snow, but to do it with good cheer. Virginia Attorney General's office says the Biscuit Run deal is being reviewed. And get the latest news of Forest Lakes Arby's, formerly the Patriots Place, and formerly Arby's. The Hook, wanted in a loving home. And let's thank Ben Around Tattoos in Charlottesville and downtown Waynesboro, feature male and female tattoo artists. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create a work design that you provide. Ben Around Tattoos in downtown Waynesboro and at 701 West Main Street in Charlottesville. For more information online, benaroundtattoos.com. And Drew Thompson should be here shortly for Les Temps Purdue at noon. best of 80s and 90s alternative music with bands like Dead Kennedys, The Bangles, and Husker Du. Brought to you in part by Orzo and the Visual Light. Requests always welcome on Les Temps Perdue. All right, back in action with our guests Chris Moore and Sandy Houseman, talking about Menhaden and the Chesapeake Bay. Another call came in, by the way, 979-0919-1877, WNRN Rocks. Menhaden seemed to be getting smaller and smaller, and there's also less Menhaden per... I can't read that. Sorry. That happens to me with my bad eyesight. But talk about the Menhaden getting smaller. Does that have to do with... You would think if there's more algae from the coal plant, why aren't the Menhaden bigger?
Right. People can see vastly different things, I think, depending upon the location they're looking. The Chesapeake Bay serves primarily as a nursery area for Menhaden. So what we would really expect to see is what a lot of people refer to as peanut bunkers, which are 1, 2, maybe 3-inch fish. They're what we refer to as younger of the year fish. It's the new age class of fish coming in the Chesapeake Bay. And that's primarily what we do see in Chesapeake Bay. In the fall, as the fish are migrating back south, they tend to winter off Hatteras during the winters. We tend to see an influx of the larger fish, and that sometimes happens depending upon weather conditions, things like that. Sometimes it doesn't. This year we had a very cold December, as I think everyone is aware, and those fish didn't migrate back into Chesapeake Bay and are now wintering off the coast of Virginia and off the coast of North Carolina. But overall, I think, you know, our concern has been the fact that we don't have a lot of those small fish coming back into Chesapeake Bay with recruitment being down, and that eventually that's going to lead to a depletion of big fish in the end, and that's probably what the caller is seeing.
Sandy, you did this report, and again, back in November. How long did it take you to do all this?
Oh, I don't know. I probably worked on it off and on for a period of months, just researching and trying to catch up with people to talk to about it.
What were some of the most interesting research points that you came up with? I mean, we've talked about a variety of things here during the hour. But even when I do the research for my program, I'm always like, oh, my God, really? I mean, the thing that I found, and we just really touched upon it, Virginia is the only state that still allows the fishing. And Maryland in the 1930s banned the method that's used, where you just really just put out a big net with very, very tiny holes and scoop it up by the billions of fish. What did you find the most interesting point?
Well, I think it was somewhat disheartening to see how slowly the political process works. You know, this has obviously been an issue for some time. Back in 2005, as Chris mentioned, a cap was put on the number of menhaden that could be caught. It was set at 230 million pounds per year, which sounds like a heck of a lot, but... Omega actually balked. They said, no, we're not going to go along with this. And it took, I guess, the better part of a year to negotiate with them. And the number was actually brought up to 240 million pounds, at which point they agreed. That surprised me, you know, that there's that kind of behind-the-scenes discussion and that these rules are not hard and fast. And then watching the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission struggling. I mean, there was a gentleman there who was saying that he's been raising this issue for 20 years now. And, you know, the matter got referred to a technical committee, which is headed by a mathematician. And if you know any mathematicians, you know that they're very persnickety about their numbers, and they take it very seriously. They're not going to fudge. They want to get it right. And so, you know, this whole thing's kind of hung up waiting on the technical committee, which in May, I believe, was charged with coming up with some recommendations for the fall. And in the fall, they hadn't done anything. You know, they had nothing to recommend. And actually, the last time the Atlantic States met, which was, what,
November
right? Still no recommendations. Still no hard numbers to look at. I mean, I think the mathematicians are very concerned by the complexity of making estimates when you're talking about fish that, you know, not in an aquarium. They're out there in the great ocean, and we don't really know everything there is to know, and therefore they're very hesitant to say, you know, how formulas might be adjusted to make this a better, ecologically a better situation.
Sandy Houseman from WVTF and Radio IQ. Chris Moore, also here, scientist from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. I love the word persnickety. I'm going to make that my word of the day. But you talked about the weight. Something I found interesting also, in tonnage, by total weight of fish brought forth, Reidsville, where the Omega Protein Corp is, second largest fishing port in the United States. So you want to talk about the amount of menhaden scooped out of the bay every year, second largest fishing port in the United States.
Yeah, and just one little caveat on that. Reidsville is this between 2 and 5 from year to year in terms of tons land of menhaden. That's not only in the bay. That's what they land coastwide. And as you had mentioned, most states have banned fishing for menhaden in their state waters. Actually, Virginia and North Carolina are the only two that do not allow fishing in their state waters from the reduction fishery. And this is the large fishery with the large ships, spotter planes, things like that.
Allow it, you mean?
Allow it, North Carolina. All the states, Maryland, good example, still allow catching a menhaden through pound nets and gill nets and things like that. But the bay quota that Sandy was referring to earlier, which is set at about 109,000 metric tons right now, a tremendous amount of fish, that's what they're allowed to catch in the bay. They do a significant amount of fishing offshore. Remember, state waters on the East Coast extend 3 miles offshore, so they've been fishing a lot up off New Jersey, off the Virginia Capes, areas like that. From them, from the economic standpoint, as Sandy mentioned, more and more of their effort is going into the production of oils for human consumption. And the larger fish, the three-year-old fish that are pushing a pound, have a lot more of that oil per volume of fish than the small fish in Chesapeake Bay, which may not be as big. So they're making a business decision the last couple of years to actually go run their ships, run their spotter planes farther offshore, farther away from their processing plant, and catch those fish out in the ocean. In addition, the bay quota, the 109,000 metric ton quota we talked about earlier, actually only extends to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, which is dependent upon where you draw the line, is very close at the north end of it, but it's still 4 to 6 miles from the ocean down at the south end of it. And they do at times a tremendous amount of fishing in that fairly narrow area because the fish are kind of confined. They're moving up in Chesapeake Bay, and a significant amount of their catch in some years comes from that area as well, and that's not actually counted against the bay quota.
11:47 here in the wake-up call. Sandy Houseman and Chris Moore here in the studio as we talk about menhaden, a vital fish for the Chesapeake Bay and the United States. I mean, you talk about it also includes the Gulf waters. Menhaden are in the Gulf. Sandy, when you did your report, did you get to go on a boat? Did you go on a spotter plane?
Actually, I did go. I did go out on a boat in the Chesapeake Bay, but at that point, the Omega fleet was elsewhere, so I didn't have a chance to observe this really aggressive fishing technique, which is called purse seining, where they put out actually a couple of different nets that are stitched together, and it's basically like a purse. In other words, they pull the top ends together, and then they pull it tight, you know, and the fish are sort of caught in this hold, and then they put a like a vacuum tube down and suck them into the hold of the ship. You know, it's very aggressive. And that was the basis for Maryland banning reduction fishing in Chesapeake Bay. They just felt it was too aggressive. It didn't give the fish a fair chance.
One of the only things that, I mean, the net is so tight isn't the word I want, but really the only thing that goes through the water, only goes through the net, is the water.
Right.
Everything else you get, you know, a crab, small minnows, I mean, it's all caught in the net, and then you suck it up through a vacuum cleaner tube.
Right.
There has been, I think, there's been a lot of interest in that bycatch in the menhaden fishery, in the reduction fishery especially, and that's actually one of the few areas that the Marine Resources Commission does regulate, is the size of the mesh that they use in those purse seines. And the purse seines actually work very well for menhaden because menhaden are a schooling fish. When they're in schools, they tend to be up near the surface, and correct Sandy just a little bit, but they actually purse from the bottom, and when they do that, the fish are kind of forced up like they would naturally, and then they pump them out. But overall, the bycatch in the fishery, believe it or not, is fairly low. And I think a lot of groups have kind of, is that number really true or not? But the Virginia Institute of Marine Science has actually done some studies on that, and especially when the nets are in water that's deeper than the length of the net. Fortunately, the bycatch within the fishery is fairly low, and they just are catching menhaden. I think there's still some concern about, as you mentioned earlier, as that net gets tighter and tighter, can some of the smaller fish escape like we would hope through the net. But overall, it's a very efficient fishery in catching the fish that they're targeting, which are menhaden.
Let's talk about the 2010 legislature bills, why they didn't have anything accomplished, and then what's up for 2011. Chris, tell us what was there for 2010, and then Sandy, I would think that you followed it, so tell us what happened to them.
Sure. The biggest bill last year related to menhaden dealt with moving the authority to manage menhaden from the General Assembly to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. There was actually another bill that was passed that basically extended that bay cap that we have for an additional 3 years, and that bill did make it out of the General Assembly and is part of state code, but those were the two bills that were in play last year.
And State Senator Ralph Northam, who is a co-sponsor of the bill to shift responsibility to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission, told me that at the last minute, labor unions got involved in the conversation, and because there was the possibility of reduced jobs in the Northern Neck, the labor unions lobbied against that bill, and he could not round up enough votes. I think he's confident that in the next session they may be able to accomplish this shift, but I haven't spoken with him recently.
And you talk about labor unions getting involved, and again, does that, and I don't know which legislators are in and would be involved in a committee, but do you nudge the legislator in the western part of the state and say, hey, if you don't vote for this, even though those 300 jobs have nothing to do with you, then we may not support you come next time?
Don't know. It's a possibility. I don't know. I wasn't privy to the conversation, so I don't know what sort of leverage the unions might have, but that was Senator Northam's perspective, that because of the involvement of organized labor, the bill didn't stand a chance.
Chris, so what's up for this year? Because my understanding was that there are more bills in this upcoming session, which I guess just recently started.
Right, started last week. This year we have the same bills in play. Senator Northam has put his bill in again this year, and much the same as last year, Delegate Cosgrove has put a piece of mirrored legislation, the exact same legislation, in on the House side as well. But there are a number of bills this year that deal with menhaden. There's a bill that would move the reduction fishery 1 mile offshore down the Hampton Roads area. There's another bill in play that would add a landings tax to do research and things like that on menhaden. There's another bill that would actually phase the fishery out over a couple years. So there's a lot of different ideas about menhaden right now. A lot of different people are more interested in the issue, and I think it'll be an interesting year in the General Assembly.
Sandy, have you done any research or looking into this year's bills and how that might play?
Not at all. I tend not to cover Richmond. We have folks who cover Richmond for us full time, so we leave it to them. But, you know, to the extent that I was in touch with Senator Northam's office and heard that he was going to try again, I trust that will be in play.
Chris Moore, scientist from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Sandy Houseman, Charlottesville News Bureau Chief with WVTF and Radio IQ. I've had a handful of people call up with their questions or comments. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks, 1153 here on the Wake Up Call. Let me thank Sugar Snap for supporting us. They offer gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats and nursing pillows, plus maternity and nursing clothes. Also at Sugar Snap, you'll find things like cloth diapers and locally made items. They have a kid-friendly play area available while you shop. More can be found at sugarsnapconsignment.com. Also find them in the same area as Whole Foods. I can't think of what that place is called. And it's not written down, so You'll have to do that yourself. 1154. Chris, talking about the 2011 bills, there was one about moving the fishing out 1 mile.
Right.
Or 1 mile away. And you also mentioned a landing fee. What is that?
Basically, the bill has been proposed to put a what we call a landings tax on the fishery so that for each metric ton, I believe, of fish landed, the industry would pay a fee for that, and it would go for various types of research on the fishery moving forward.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that today, that, you know, there is a real need, and the chief biologist for Omega Protein admits there's a need for more research to the extent that it's expensive to do it. It really hasn't been done, you know, that there's nobody out in the open ocean looking around to see what the menhaden populations are like. And so it occurred to me that possibly the industry needed to step up and assist with that.
Do you think that either of those will be, or any of those will be, put through?
It'll be interesting to see. I think a lot of those type issues that are being contemplated by new legislation this year are issues that are better dealt with at the Marine Resources Commission, and that's really why the Bay Foundation's focus the last 2 years has been to work on the legislation that moves the management of the fishery to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. You know, bills that would move the fishery offshore model and things like that. VMRC deals with those type of user conflicts basically on a monthly basis when they meet. They have a long history of doing that. They have the scientist on staff. They can go out and get help from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science if they'd like to. A lot of these issues that are coming up would just be better dealt with at the commission level and not in a very confined General Assembly session each year.
Now, the commission does consider things other than science, right?
They do. They consider economic impact, things like that, in their decisions. It's a group of gubernatorial appointees. They represent all different areas of the state, and Virginia has a long history of citizen representation and on boards like that. We have the Air Board and the Water Board and things like that in Virginia. So it really bodes well for all interest in the state to be represented when we have a regulatory body like that in the state.
This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst-Lynchburg. Just another minute or two left with our guests today, Sandy Houseman and Chris Moore. Chris, Sandy, what happens if things are moved from the legislature to the VMRC? Does that really affect how the menhaden are treated and fished?
I would say probably not, only to the extent that the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission is really the body that everyone looks to for guidance in terms of limits on the catch. So, you know, somebody said to me, it really doesn't matter whether the VMRC decides or the legislature decides. Everybody's just following the recommendation of this regional group that represents 15 states.
I think the biggest change that we would see in the future is the fact that Virginia can act more efficiently in the process. And a great example is what happened during the last General Assembly session. We adopted a new, basically an additional 3 years of the cap because Virginia could only make regulations during that very confined period. Well, everybody knew that this new stock assessment that came out during the summer and the fall was going to come out, but Virginia couldn't make a management decision with the best available data because they were confined by this period. So in the future, I think we'll see decisions that are made in a more timely manner with the best available science on Virginia's side.
And should the Atlantic states choose to impose a stricter limit on the catch, we might not be faced with the prospect that we saw in 2005 where the company just said, no, we're not going to do it. We don't like your numbers, and we don't agree, and we're not going to follow these recommendations. And the legislature went along, basically.
Yeah, that was, I think, again, highlighted some of the concern. The Virginia, you know, should have adopted this. We adopt these type of mandates annually from ASMSC for other species like striped bass and summer flounder. And we got into a very interesting situation. And the real hammer that could have been dropped on Virginia is the Department of Commerce can come in and shut down that entire fishery if Virginia doesn't come into compliance. And that's not a situation we want to see for anybody. I mean, we want healthy fisheries. We want economically viable fisheries that are managed well. And we don't want to see other components of the menhaden fishery like the poundnet fishery or the gillnet fishery shut down while Virginia is negotiating with the federal government on an issue like this.
Sandy, just about 60 seconds left. You went to Reidsville. It seems like, from my understanding, Reidsville exists on the Omega Protein Corporation. What happens if that business does shut down and we have Virginians losing their jobs? Is that correct, or you just find something else to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what the positive picture might just be that once that plant closes, tourism becomes much more vibrant. The smell of the air is better, and presumably, you know, there will be other things that rise to take its place. With efforts to clean up the bay, for example, we do expect the creation of jobs. So, you know, it's a group of 350 people. These are seasonal jobs to start with. One would hope that Virginia's economy is big enough to absorb them in some other capacity.
All right. Thanks to both of you for coming in. Chris Moore, scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Sandy Houseman here in Charlottesville as the News Bureau Chief, WVTF. I love listening to your special program. Thank you so much. All right. Drew Thompson up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.